This is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Jay and Lehman, and today we will get to an email, and then we will talk about the third key to making your Torg Eternity game great, which is know your players. But before we do that, like I said, we have an email from Oliver. Oliver's written at least once or twice before, so thank you for the emails. And anybody else, you can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com, and we will read your emails like this one, and we'll answer the questions to the best of our ability, etc. So
they don't all need to be rules clarifications.
Yes. Yeah, they can be anything, but yeah, you can ask questions, or you can just tell us what you think. Anything, we'll read them. So, okay. So this one says, hi again, folks. So this time it got a bit more expansive. You might split it into two debriefings, but I think we can hit all of these. So they're broken up into three parts, gene mods, armor, and spell multi-targeting or spells type things. So the first one is full body armor and gene mods like dermal mods or weapons. Can gene mods like quill bracers be used in full body armor? Or would you say any armor that is full body and non-mystic in nature prevents the use of gene mods that need quote unquote free parts of the body? So Jay, what are your thoughts on that? If you had a player who's like, I want to have these gene mods like quill bracers, but I also want full body armor, so I get the benefits of that, how would you do that?
I would probably not let them work together unless they modified it somehow. So base power armor would totally nullify quill bracers. And I can't remember if quill bracers can be hidden or if they're fully out all the time, but I would think if they're fully out all the time, you just wouldn't be able to even wear power armor at all, because that's like your body. So that's definitely a talk with your GM situation. As far as how much I would make it cost to change it, that's a pretty tough question, because often these are granted by perks that don't necessarily have a dollar value, like the gene mods do, but the power suits don't, or even just like regular stuff. But from other role-playing game experience, I would probably just add an extra 50% cost onto it or something, and make it hella difficult, if not impossible, to just requisition. Because what the odds of them having destroyer armor are already bad enough. What are the odds of them having destroyer armor that could deploy quills? So, I mean, that's sort of a situation of your own making there. I would not allow it unless the player came to me with a beautiful story that made me weep with joy.
So, I don't necessarily think that I would make them make me a story that would make me cry in happiness. But I have like a similar thoughts on that. It doesn't flat out explain it in the rules, and there you start getting into Game Master territory. But I can think of various media, like stuff that we've talked about, where you could have, you know, a character that had some quills sticking out of their arms and stuff and still have full body armor, but it would be a modified thing. So yes, I would agree with you. I wouldn't allow it for requisitions. If they're going to buy it, then I would like just normal armor and not perk based armor, that a 50% modification fee or something like that would be very reasonable. And then for things like power armor or perk based armor, if you want to expand on that, I would probably just have it as one of those extra perks, you know, the little tag-on perks, the ones that sometimes get rid of some penalties or give you some bonuses or whatever, depending on what type of armor it is. But there's all of those little add-on perks, and I would probably just say, okay, you want it there, then buy it with a perk if it's for those. So That would be my thoughts on that. So, number two, would range increases to jump stack, such as power armor plus gene mods, or would again only the highest bonus be counted? So this one, I'll just say the current official thing, and then Jay, you can say if you have different thoughts on it, but it's the stacking rule. If they're the exact same bonus type, then they wouldn't stack, but if they were different, then they would. So why am I saying that? There might be something that says, like, you jump X many times your dex, and another one just says you jump for your, like, and gives an actual additional meters or something like that. So if they're talking about modifying the same thing, they wouldn't stack. If they're talking about modifying different things that would both lead to a jump increase, then they would stack. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't think they would stack just also from logically the way these things work. Like, if it's from power armor, you could probably have anybody in there and it would still let you jump pretty much just as far. And other things probably logistically wouldn't stack. Like, you could have a gene mod and a cyber leg, but they probably wouldn't work together, right? So I would just think most of the time it wouldn't stack. Maybe if it was like due to magic or psionics or something, but those generally have better things to do than jumping, like full flying and stuff. So again, if someone really came at it, maybe, but I would err on no.
Okay, so then let's get to armor. This one is, does natural armor from animal count as full body armor, or would they have zero armor if attacked with fire or another attack that uses lowest armor value? So what would your opinion be on if that came up in your game?
This is a question that has plagued me since the very beginning, to be honest.
Okay.
Because the idea, okay, it's got scales and like armor all over it, but if you look at any like dragon or what have you, it's not fully armored everywhere. Like, its eyes are exposed, there are weak points. So, I mean, my players luckily are not going to see this, so I feel safe to say that I change my opinion on what to do on a case-by-case basis. But generally speaking, what I usually would do, it's not official or anything, but is I would take half of their armor and count that as full body armor.
Okay, that's a... I can see that being a nice middle ground between a no and yes. For me, this is something that I am sure that the majority of creators, designers of animals were never thinking about. And that's probably why it's never been defined. Because a lot of times we might not think about things that other people like yourself have been thinking about since day one. I would say this is up to the game master, because as you said, certain things seem like their armor would be more, have more coverage than not, but something that's big enough, maybe you can't fully attack it with the whatever fire or attack that would bypass the armor. Things like a creature similar to a box turtle is going to, I think, be able to hold itself up, you know, in its shell better than something that's only can partially, you know, retract its body into its armor, things like that. Or is it facing you? Is it not facing you? And that's a lot of stuff that Torg Eternity doesn't necessarily get into nor wish to get into. So this could even be a, like I said, with the turtle, if you have some living land, big giant box turtle creature attacking the party, and for whatever reason it goes full defensive, then yeah, I would say its armor counts. And if not, and it's all exposed, you know, the head and the four legs are out, and the guy with the flamethrower is right there, then okay, yeah, it's not going to count. But if it's from the back and there's less or from the side, then maybe do your like half of the body armor. So I think with animals, it's a little bit different, because you're going to have different animals with different types of armor. So I'm not going to just say no, none of them, or like every single one of them gets full body armor. Not going to say that. And I'm also not going to say yes, everyone does get full body armor, because animals, by their very nature, differ from each other. So that's kind of what I would
Yeah.
go with.
I would probably err on no unless it says something specifically. If in the creature description it boasts about their tough shell or something
Right.
like that, maybe. But
Like,
otherwise, probably not.
it's hard to crack their shell or hard to get past their thing. So yeah, look at the reading of it, figure that out. Game masters kind of think, and if you gotta say, hey, if you want to get that completely no armor, you're gonna have to maneuver around them or something like that. That's fine. Or right now you're in the clear, and have it be a not just a creature by creature situation, but if you want to get really tactical in it, you could have a situation by situation that's changing as the combat in the battlefield does. So, spell multi-targeting. So four, which mystic abilities? And whenever we're talking about mystic abilities, that's the new catch-all term for magic, psionics, and miracles. So anything that does things with supernatural-ish type stuff, but isn't supernatural evil per se, that is lumped into a mystic ability. It's just a way that we can, starting in year two, differentiate between if something only affects magic or is not affected by magic. And then the question always comes up, well, what about psionics or what about miracles? So, year two forward, if it says all mystic can affect it or all mystic can't affect it, that means all three of the things, and then vice versa. If it's just magic affects it, then divine and psionics wouldn't, and the same with if divine affects it or psychic stuff affects it. So that just wanted to clarify for anybody listening why this term is being used. But it says which mystic abilities can multi-target and which spells can never multi-target. Obviously, any spells with the limitation spelled out, as well as any AoE spells, but there are several that don't have limitation spelled out, but it seems to be intended as a single target only, such as Monkey's Paw, Speak with the Dead, Crucifixion, Infernal Judgment, Healing, etc. So, how to identify if multi-targeting is possible? So, Jay, what are your thoughts on that? Other than we can't go through every single, I mean, I guess we could, but it would take forever to go through
Yeah.
every single spell, miracle, and psychic power just to say, can it multi-target?
I mean, the number one is up to the GM, I guess. Like, it's the big one. Otherwise, I mean, unless it specifically says you can't, then you can. Unless the range makes it impractical. Like, if you have to touch someone, you can only touch so many people realistically, right? But yeah, like that's sort of my official read of it. And like, I'm not sure, even as a GM, like, I don't know. I think my players just never thought about doing it for some of these, so it's never really come up. But healing is kind of a weird one, because I guess just, I don't know why I would do it. Heal, I guess, if time is a real issue, but the thought of failing that would be bad. But and then the fact that sometimes, like, some might get healed or not. But yeah, I mean, that I think that's what it is. Yeah, you in theory can multi-target anything as long as it's not an AoE or specifically precluded, like in Lightning Strike.
Right, that's how I would see it officially now. I will say in year two again, this is all cleaned up and will be much clearer on when those situations are allowed. But certain things like healing, somebody wanted to heal two people or three or the whole everybody, everybody just got completely messed up that round. So the healer's like, oh no, I gotta heal, everybody. Can I multi-target? Well, you're getting a penalty for doing that anyway. And then you only get basically one chance per scene or act. I can't remember what's the base, and there might be
Yeah,
there's, I think, an
scene.
aisle that might speed it up.
Oh yeah.
But either way, it's like, if you, like you said, if you failed, then oops, that really, messes up with everybody. Nobody gets to get healed with that miracle after that. So it's that, to me, that's a good risk versus reward, because the risk is pretty high, but the reward is also pretty high.
Just don't forget that the difficulties apply is modified by all of the wounds. So,
Right. So once you start applying everybody's wounds, everybody is a multi-target, it's going to be more difficult. Things like crucifixion, infernal judgment, speak with the dead, that would be kind of, I think, a weird multi-targeting. You have ask questions, or you get multiple dead talking to
You do have to
you
literally
in
puppet
public
their
there. You're right.
mouth
So maybe you have
like
to
that.
do both. You can have one in
Yeah.
each hand or something. Monkey's paw, I would probably tend to not, because it's more of a ritual type mentality. But game masters have the ultimate, authority to figure out what's going on. But all in all, I would do it like you said, Jay, because a lot of those mystic effects will specify, like, cannot be used multi-target, can't multi-target with it, and all the area effect ones already can't be multi-target just by the fact that they are area of effects.
Which was
So,
in a FAQ
right.
previously.
Yes.
For anyone who thinks that was just, where'd this come from?
So then last question is five. Some abilities reference faith as base value for damage. Is the pure base, man, I cannot talk today. Let me just start all over. Some abilities reference faith as base value for damage. Is the pure base value skill ranks plus attributes or attribute, and the skill ranks we call adds, used, or is the adjusted faith value used, such as modified by things such as bless, magic items, powers, etc. So what are your thoughts on that, Jay?
I don't know.
Okay.
I am not sure.
So I would say yes. If you use bless, you raise somebody's dex, they're going to be able to hit better. If you raise their spirit, they're going to be able to do more damage, cast their or invoke their miracles better, etc. So if it's raising either your add or your attribute for that base value, then I would say sure, your base value for that damage. It's just like using bless on strength for that to get that melee weapon to do more damage. So that would
Yeah, I
be
guess
the
shock
take.
and toughness aren't skill values, which is why they don't get
Right.
affected by these, but it is still asking for the skill value, which has been modified.
Right. So it's an actual skill. It's a skill value. If your adds and or attribute or the skill, like if you're from the Nile Empire and you have super skill faith, then I would say yeah, that's added to faith damage if you wish to go there. So thank you very much, Oliver, for those questions. And now we can get into the last and final key of making your Torg game great. So just as a recap, because it's been a while, plus we did a lot for the second one. The first one is Know Your Rules. You don't have to know the ins and outs of them, but just being able to understand the rules, figure out what type of system it is, what the base, the core mechanic for Torg that's going to be, knowing how that bonus chart works and how the card play works. The second thing is knowing your setting. That's where we had to branch off in many directions, because unlike other role-playing games out there, lots of role-playing games out there, there isn't just one setting. There's practically eight and more if you start counting the little mini-cosms, as well as things like conquered worlds that the Storm Knights might go into, Akasha, Kadandra, stuff like that. So we had to kind of break it up into the main things. But the third one is Know Your Players, and it can be different because you might have a group like I have that you've been running, especially Torg, classic Torg, since the early 1990s, and you might kind of know your group. And there is a certain thing where at a time you kind of get comfortable with the group and you understand the players, what they like, what they dislike and stuff. But then you go to the opposite extreme and it could be a pickup group or a group at a con. So you don't have the time to really get to know your players and stuff like that. But knowing them can really help. And I know we've kind of hinted at this as like how to make NPCs, villains that your players hate, not just the characters, but the players hate, or the ones that they love, and we
love to hate,
or love to hate. Right. You know, there's lots of little things you can do with that, and knowing your players can really help with that. So Jay, do you have anything right off the bat that you might be thinking about, like what's a good way to figure out some certain things with players, or what are good things to know about them that can help you?
Well, there's been all manner of game theory stuff come out in the past like 30, 40 years. Sure. And in the last five, it's probably gone up exponentially as the YouTube sphere is just filled with people cramming out opinions and their own little things. But there's always been kind of like the four classic types of players. So it's kind of like trying to identify what they are. Because the thing is, you're probably not also going to have uniformly all the same kind of player. It's going to be a mixed group. And a lot of GMing is figuring out the delicate dance of keeping everybody satisfied, even though they all want, they all yearn deep down to split apart and run off.
Right.
Do their own thing. So you need to appease that. So I wasn't actually really sure where we wanted to start here, because I've got some ideas on the types of players, and also the kind of game that you're running is greatly going to affect this, whether it's your ongoing home game, whether you're advertising for a new game, like a home game to start, whether it's a convention or a demo or even like a Torganized play game is going to change things. And then, as we've alluded to previously in the Tharkold and Ororsh ones, session zero and safety tools and how that's usually not actually an issue. Like, you don't have time to do a session zero for like a convention game. So all of these are different things we can look at, I guess. I don't know what you were thinking of.
So all of those topics are really good, and I think we should at least try to hit those. So let's talk about your home game, the home game with your group that you already know. Maybe you have been playing with them 30 or so years. Do you just say, hey, we're going to play Torg, it's this multi-genre thing, and then you jump into it? Or would you still, and I know there's been a lot of, like, you know, as you just said, session zero talk started, and there has been pushback, various types of pushback. And I don't want to get into that kind of like politicking type thing, but I can say that in my home game, with my home group that I've been playing decades for, sometimes people's opinions mm-hmm. on things change, or things that they might have tolerated 40 years ago, they're not going to tolerate. A lot of things can happen too. As my day job, working in a crime laboratory, there are times when people will get families and have children, and then when crimes occur against children, they will say, hey, could you take this crime? Because it's a little too, you know, to me, where a couple years previously it would have been okay. So as people grow older, as their life situation changes, then certain topics that they might have been able or wanted to do previously, now they just prefer not to do. You know, so, mm-hmm. no, don't want to go there anymore. Did that when I was younger. I changed my mind. So in those type of things, I do recommend you at least kind of touch base with your players, and knowing that can help, because you don't want, especially for that home group that's been together for 3 or 4 decades, you don't want a falling out to happen because you right. assumed something. The same group, another person who game masters, we got to a point where things, the stakes were getting higher, our characters getting more noticed, and the plot, or the overarching meta plot type thing of the game, is there's these ancient horrors out there that come out and they like kill people, but they do really nasty things against people, and they might make it so that your character does things, you know, against their will and things like that. Even knowing us for, you know, 30, 40 years, he asked, hey, does anybody have a problem if things like this might happen? I'm not saying they will, but this is kind of how these games progress, and we were able to talk about that even as an established group. So for my big thing on established groups is every once in a while you just want to check in with your players to make sure that what was okay yesterday is still okay today. So what are your thoughts on that established group?
Yeah, that's pretty important. And another thing also, which is, it's one of those things that when you say it, it makes you sound kind of smarmy, but it's like, you know, you need to know, like, there's what your players tell you they want to do, and then there's what they actually want to do.
Right.
Right? You know, they'll say they want to do something, and you know that's not what they're going to do. Because I recently went through this with my group. I held a symposium before our D&D campaign. It was like, what do you guys want to do? And, like, made sure everyone talked. Because, you know, sometimes you get a player who's like, I'll just do what everyone wants.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, it's like, no, I want to know what you want to do. And then I tried to forge this exact thing that they said they wanted for, like, 3 levels. And then I eventually just sort of gave up and let them just go do what they wanted to do, what they were actually were doing. Right? Uh-huh. So that kind of comes down to it. As I was talking, there's like the iconic sort of 4 types of players. Mm-hmm. And I guess knowing how to identify them and then what to do for them, which could probably be, and probably is, like its own like 2-hour seminar somewhere on YouTube. I'm sure Bob World Builder's got like tons of these, but how you basically have the achievers, the explorers, the socializers, and the killers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the achievers just want to get it done. And ironically, like, I think this is what I see the most in Torg, especially in Torganized play, is like people are like, no, we're going to go scene by scene, and we're going to get it done, we're going to get our XP, and we're out.
Right.
And that's kind of a danger you get into with the serialized nature of like a convention game or a Torganized play game, where you bring your character to do, like, or West Marches in general, mm-hmm. like where you come to do like one specific mission, and then you're back out.
Right.
So people are just looking to get it done. They're not really there to smell the roses necessarily. They're looking for clues, but they're not looking to dilly-dally and talk to people and get all the extra lore and everything that you might have worked on. So for those kind of players, you want to make sure you've got things that are clear and they know why they're doing things. Then you have the explorers, which are kind of the opposite. They want to just sort of see what's going on. They're very interested in how this tribe in the living land is living. Like, oh, what god are they worshiping? Is it Lenala? Is it something else? Where? How are you getting food, guys? You know, or they want to see cool new things, and they might want to go looking for wonders and get distracted from whatever the mission at hand is. And Torg is a game where you can have infinite distractions. There's always something weird going on. And then from what happens with charisma, socializers might be some less in Torg, but that's definitely a big thing. There's like part of the entire concept of Torg Eternity is bringing hope to the people. So just doing the glories is part of it, but also going out there and talking to people who've transformed, who are holding out in some core Earth hardpoint somewhere, is a big part of the campaign. And there are people, especially with Critical Role being as popular as it is, a lot of people, to a lot of people, role playing is more kind of like story driven, or rather more character driven, I should say. Like they want to go out and play their character. They're not necessarily just about being, using their perks and guns and stuff. They want their background to come to the forefront, and they need NPCs to do that with. And they want to build connections, whether it be with a connection card or not. And then finally, there's people who just want to kill Edinos and shock troopers to their heart's content. And they will just maximize. They will get the biggest guns they can find, the biggest AoEs they can find. And you just need to send minions to them into the meat grinder. And you want to make it interesting, though. You can't just be like, okay, and some more shock troopers come and they're shooting at you and they miss and you kill them. Like, it has to actually still be fun. Especially for people that like really are into Pathfinder 2 and those kind of games with lots of crunch to the combat, which doesn't really matter when you get right down to it. It's all kind of like just you're pulling a bunch of levers, but you're going to win anyway. They want to feel that they're pulling the lever and it's their special lever and that they're doing it, right? So you want to always make it like a big thing for those kinds.
No, I agree, and something that you mentioned that I kind of thought about is, and it can also, even if you know your players, it can be different depending on what type of game you run. Like I was thinking when you were talking about the socializer being the complete opposite, or not socializer, sorry, the explorer being the complete opposite of the like achiever, that when I was at Gen Con this last, month or so ago, I was playing in a game and we had a goal. You know, it was like a this many hours and it's real time, so if when the game ends, the adventure ends, and if you haven't done the goal, then you lose. If you have done the goal, then you win. And we got within like 3 minutes. But the two goals we had, one was to a king had been captured, basically held in this inn, the city kind of taken over, and there were some nobles there. So like primary mission, save the king, rescue him. Secondary mission, save and rescue the nobles. Well, we're going into the inn and we spend way too long, figuring out what we're gonna do. But we finally get in there and we rescue a noble. And I'm just like, okay, we're supposed to rescue these people. I look out the window and there's this carriage out there, but the horses have been eaten because undead, type stuff. But it's a carriage and nobody's around it. So I convince the noble to jump on my back, and then I climb out the window, climb down, tell him to stay put in the carriage. And then like every noble that we rescued, I spent like half of those encounters carrying the people back and forth, back or to the carriage, dropping them off, putting them in, be quiet, come back, because I was focused on the achievement. I was focusing, this is one of the things that we're told to do, and nobody else is doing it, so I'm gonna do it. Whereas in a open sandbox game, I'm the explorer. I'm the person who I want to find out the lore. I want to figure out those things. I keep a journal. which is a good and bad things because I usually write down just what's interesting to me or my character.
Right.
And so, like, some things, the game master, if they like forget or misplace notes or whatever, they're going like, "Hey, Leeming, do you have this?" And I can look it up and go, "Oh yeah, I got this guy's name and this one." And then they'll ask like another question. It's like, I have nothing. There is
Yeah,
nothing because
I didn't talk to that
that was them. I don't know, what happened with
guy.
that. So I see where, like, when you're describing that, I could be either way depending on the situation. If it's a goal, and a lot of the Torg, especially the Delphi missions, are very like, here's your goal, here's your thing, here's your act, you do it. Whereas the ones, my campaign that I have, that people go on lots of different things, we break apart acts, we do stuff, that's a lot more open. So your players might lean towards one of those things that normally they wouldn't, depending on the thing. And the other thing I had was the where you say you can plan something, you can ask your players what they want, they'll tell you, and it's not actually what they want. So that can, get a little iffy. So I had a bunch of players who were tired of all the hack and slash. And we're like, we still want to play this game. It was L5R first edition way back in the day. And they're like, but we would like more of the investigation, socialization, type thing, not just the, oh, go out and kill opposing samurai or the whatever the areas of the monsters were called in that. I don't remember it off the top of my head. It was like the corrupted area that the Crab Clan held off for, that type of stuff. So, I came up with a detective-ish story, and we go to a session. Everybody's like, "Oh, this is really cool. We're figuring out clues. We're talking to people. We're socializing. Blah blah blah." And then session two comes along, and they're like, "Oh yeah, that was like kind of cool. We got a little further. We picked up some clues. We think we know what's going on." And then the third session, near the end, they were like shaking because they wanted to kill things so badly. They're like, and I didn't observe this. I was just like, I'm just tunnel vision going along the socialization investigation path that they had set, or they had asked me to set for them. And I had, in that game, we had multiple game masters, so we would switch around, and sometimes we would use our own characters as kind of like a little GMPC for just like a, hey, here's a clue, or hey, I figured out this thing. A little fail for before fail forward was actually like known that those are the words to use. We used them kind of like that. And so they weren't getting a specific clue. So I'm like, okay, I'll just have my samurai come in and, give them to him. But my samurai was a Scorpion Clan samurai, which are like the little sneaky ones. And I like starting to have my character, sneak through the window. And I'm like, okay, whatever their version of awareness or perception was, and okay, one of the characters sees a shadow, like rolled, but didn't roll great, so he didn't pick out details. Okay, you see a shadowy form coming in through the window. Spear right through my character, dead. Boom, right then. And it was just like, okay, so after that, I'm like, I can go two sessions without combat, but no more than that. Otherwise, combat will occur in the session. And, they felt really bad about it and stuff like that. We're like, oh no, we actually like that character. But it happens.
I had that happen in high school as well, where people like, we want to play a real vampire game, like not superheroes with fangs, but like a real political intrigue vampire game. So I made up all these webs of contacts and like who owed who favors. And like game two in the Elysium, they just like talked some crap to the prince and got themselves executed. Like it's like, so the thing, yeah, you gotta, is what they want, is what they really want, is what they think they want. You gotta, it's tough to know because like you're gonna want to do it, but you have to watch and be vigilant. And I should mention that for the four like archetypes, no one is just one of those things. Like they're all a bit of everything. But one of my players is definitely high on the kill side,
So,
I will say.
so having said that, let's go to the complete opposite. So as a game master, you're going to a con and you're like, hey, I think I'm going to game master at this con. So you come up with your nifty little adventure, you know, you figured out, you know, if you want them to be, you know, say in Torg Eternity, hey, here's some beginning archetypes, pick from these. But you have no idea who your players are unless, like, a bunch of your friends sign up for your game. And then I think, well, why didn't you just, you know, play at their house or whatever? But you, say you get a group and you don't know anybody, you've never played with them before. What are some things that as a game master you can use to help that game succeed?
Depends on what kind of convention game it is. Mm-hmm. If it's a demo versus if it's like a just a convention game.
Let's
because
talk,
a demo, just... you're going in assuming they know nothing.
Right.
Whereas most convention games, you're assuming they at least know the system somewhat.
Right.
Right? Like, because if you just hand them an archetype, you're an electric samurai. They'd be like, what the hell is this? Right?
Okay, so let's do both. Let's do a scenario where you have, or maybe it's three. One is... It might not be a demo, but just nobody's played it. You know, it's like a newer game has came out, so it's not like it's being play tested, but it's new. Nobody knows the system. And then we'll do one that everybody's somewhat familiar with it, you know, like a D&D, or one that you might have some new people and some people.
I always thought the day ones were really neat for the idea of you start as a normal ord. Mm-hmm. And then become a Storm Knight, but the problem is that just takes too long.
Right.
If you're doing a convention game, so I mean the biggest thing is really attitude, right? Be ready to talk to people. This is it sounds obvious, but I mean personally, in my day-to-day like life, I work in like not retail, but like. With people.
Right.
I teach board games for a living is what I do. So like teaching newbies at a demo is actually pretty much par for the course for me. And
okay.
It's kind of like what I do on a daily basis. So it's basically, you have to be able to quickly peg how much everyone's paying attention and how interested they are in different things. Are they picking up the dice and rolling the dice a lot? Are they reading their characters' backstories? Or are they just looking at the stats?
Uh-huh. Right?
There's a lot of little things that you need to pay attention to in the first like 10, 15 minutes. You do want to give like a very basic pitch, and the adventure should be relatively basic, but also show some of the weird Torg stuff that happens, right? Gosspog are cool and all, like, but they, at you know, at its core, they're just zombies.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to use Gosspog, but you probably want to include some uniquely Torg stuff. So Edinos or, you know, Vikings are kind of iffy, you know, but Nile Empire is usually a good way to go too. A lot of it is basically explaining it bit by bit as well. We're going to start off, don't even give them cards to start with, right? Like just have them make some rolls for some basic things at the very beginning, which again is something that the day one Living Land did good to make you make swimming checks at the very beginning to learn, okay, this is how a roll works, right? This is how it goes, and get them into that. And of course, go easy on them. Torg is very hard to die in, but for complete noobs that don't know what they're doing, there will be some like atrocious card play. But the funny thing is I think a lot of the time when you see people really get into Torg is when the card play clicks. So you definitely do want to introduce it. And that actually kind of brings almost a fifth archetype to Torg, I guess, like the sort of strategist, because there is this underlying almost board gamey aspect between the card play as well. And some people, I guess it's the achievers technically, but some people really get into that, right? So a lot of it is just be observant, watch what the players are doing, and kind of cycle towards them. But I think one of the most important things you can do, and this is just in any game, but especially a demo, or at a convention is try to get everybody involved and don't be like I will be way more lenient about things at a convention game when someone asks to use their science skill to do some ridiculous, weird science thing, which technically by the rules would not work. I might be like, sure, it sounds like you had a cool idea. You're getting into character. Let's have you do it. If this was a home game, I would probably not let this fly. So I will let more interesting things go. Those are sort of the main things. If it's a convention game, obviously a lot of things just are pretty self-explanatory. Make it a shorter adventure, that sort of thing. Make some pressure. Yeah, but as far as identifying the players, try to have something for everybody. Have like a social encounter in there somewhere. Have a puzzle. Have some bad guys to kill, and have a, as I mentioned before, a clear objective.
So a couple of things to add on to the convention is a lot of times you won't know who, well, like I said, you wouldn't know who is appearing. So one of those things, and I'm just going to point you out into the podcast slash YouTube world of when you have problem players, you might have to shortly take a player to the side, or you might just say, hey, let's not go there. This is a, public. There's other people around us, because sometimes some players can get, kind of cross some lines that would be okay at their home game, but not necessarily in a convention. So as a game master, be prepared that that might happen. Figure out, who else is in the party. Make sure that no, harassment or even harassment by proxy is going on, stuff like that. So you might have to almost be, and one of the terms game masters in the past was referee, but you might actually have to be a referee and, tell a person, sorry, but you need to either tone your stuff down, pull that stuff back, or I'm gonna have to, move you out of this game. So that is going to have to be a tough talk. Convention-wise, I haven't had that happen.
Yeah, me neither.
One of the games that I was at Gen Con, one of the players got close, and I could almost feel like a little discomfort, and the game master was able, and if you're good enough, I don't know how I would have been as a game master, but he was good enough to kind of just be a like, oh yeah, okay, and then and then curve it back around to the game. So if you can do that, that's very well done as well. But just kind of be aware that different, like we said, when even with your home group, people might have different things that they'll accept, they won't accept, and in a convention, you as the game master won't even have that familiarity with the players to understand that. Instantly, oh, that person's that, because it can come out of weird left fields. But just be kind of prepared for that. In my house games, that's only in like 40 years, that's only occurred a couple of times, and in both times, it was by a regular of the group bringing in a friend to play. And then that friend caused the disruptions, and it was like, hey, sorry, but don't invite them back. They're not, you're cool. They're just not doing, what we want to go with. They're doing things really weird, and don't want that in my game. So, be sure to not let your players or a particular player ruin it for everybody, including yourself. And I know it can be extremely hard to confront somebody in that. I understand it. With my job and with jobs in the past, we've had to go to like certain trainings to like de-escalate situations and stuff. And a lot of times they're like, well, do this or say these words. And the only thing I'm thinking in my head is like, if that was said at the place that I worked 2 years ago, you would get your face punched in, that type of thing. So kind of just be aware, keep keep safety in mind, direct things as you can. I don't want to scare anybody from game mastering, but it's just things that you just have to kind of...
It is worth noting, too, that Torg being set in the real world does also potentially have some other things that could happen, like especially if you're doing like a virtual con and people are from all over the world, and if you're dealing in Tharkold in Ukraine or something like that, you might get people with varying different opinions on things. So best to make things known ahead of time and, as you said, be able to de-escalate.
Right. So that's just something that I was thinking of to just kind of put out there, because the last thing you want to do or have happen to you as a game master is something like that happen and you not expect it. You know, you go in with a fresh mind going, oh man, I'm going to game master. You know, this is the first time I'm game mastering at a con. This is going to be fun. I'm pumped. I got all my, you know, my characters ready to hand out. I got this, I got that. And then to get a disruptive player. And while you're going to have to determine, when can I adjust the player, you know, naturally through the game, narratively, or if it's a, we just can't play, otherwise everybody is not having fun except for that one person. So that's something, and it goes along with the know your players, because, and it's just a picking up things. Oh, they said that one time, okay, it wasn't that, but now they're pressing it a little bit further. So let's get into the, you're at a convention, and everybody knows Torg. And they're fine to, you know, okay, yeah, you know, in my home game, I'm, you know, gamma level, but I'm fine with playing, you know, this brand new alpha character, and they seem willing and everything. And everybody at the table at least knows some part of, you know, Torg, how it works. You don't have to explain the bonus chart or how the cards work and stuff. So what are the things that you could see that might be a little rough that you might have as a game master? It might be advantageous to understand how different Torg players play or how different role players play to keep your game going great.
Well, first, tell them what house rules you're using.
Yes.
And ask if they are used to using any house rules. after that, ask them for a character introduction, even though it is a character you've probably just given them.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them to explain it from that very short thing that will tell you how much they are paying attention to the background versus how much they are paying attention to the stats. Do they talk about their gun? Or do they talk about their background?
Right.
Yeah, you know, that will give you a little bit of information right off the bat. A lot of it is also dependent on the adventure that you made, mm-hmm. right? So this goes back to what I said for the other one. It's pretty much the exact same situation. You want to make sure you have a little bit of something for everybody, mm-hmm. except now you don't really have to make it as introductory, and you can kind of just let them go with it. And Torg is one of those games that, because it is fairly player friendly, sometimes you don't even have to have a plan for how they succeed. They will figure something out.
Right.
There's all kinds of ways to do things. So just make sure you account for every play style and then pay attention to what they're doing. The one thing to really watch for is sometimes people are quiet. That might be because someone has been louder and is taking the spotlight, but sometimes it's because they actually don't want to talk a lot. So you have to be able to kind of read that situation. But either way, you still want to kind of address everybody. So when it comes to combat and everything, make sure you ask everybody what they want to do. And this is kind of something I've taken from Shadow Dark, is that even in non-combat situations, ask everyone what they're doing, and find out. Don't let one person just keep doing everything all the time. Some people might prefer not to do anything, and then they have the chance to say, oh no, I'll follow.
Right.
But it does, some people do want to do something, but they don't want to say that they want to, so that gives them an actual excuse, you know, to actually do it. And then try to entice role playing as well. Some people, especially the achiever types, get so caught up in just doing the mission that they kind of miss the whole point of, in my opinion, like some of the best parts of the hobby is to try to get their characters to interact, because that's what actually makes games memorable. I find even in Hackmaster, which was like infamous for doing these dungeons at Gen Con, there was always these crazy dungeons, that different teams would be competing against, and it was all very player versus GM, but it was all in cheek, it was all kind of in character, but still, it was all the weird player interactions that people would still remember, not just who died to green slime in room 3A, right? So that's the kind of thing I like to sort of engender. I'd be a little bit more strict about things, but not super strict. I will still let people, even if it's like Torg people, like people that know Torg, I will still let them get away with things that they probably wouldn't be able to get away with at my home table, just to have a good fun showing. You want everyone to come out of it feeling good about the situation, even if they lost, right? So that's really the trick, and there's no real easy way to say how to do it. It's just practice.
I will completely agree with the ask everybody there, especially at a convention, because some people will act differently if they're in their home game with they're used to everybody and they're still trying to figure out the players as a player themselves. Like, I don't want to step anybody's toes. Or what I found out about myself is I don't want to. I like so much don't want to be the hog, the spotlight hog, that a lot of times I won't say what I want to do because I'm waiting for everybody else. And then somebody just, as you said, you might get one or two people that then they take it and they keep going and going and going and going with it. Whereas, like, I was in a Shadow Dark game, and then the game master came around to me and was like, "What do you want to do?" And then I got to say what I want to do. And again, if you don't want to do something, I've had it where a player in the middle of battle just didn't have battle skills and was like, "I'm going to hide behind the barrel," type thing. At least in Torg, he was able to, like, pop up and taunt, and do other things once he got there. But it was just kind of like, "Ah, I'm just going to go there and let the fighters, fight." So yes, be sure that everybody is engaged as much as they want to be, as long as what they want isn't just to steal the spotlight, if that makes sense. So, having, hey, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? Really good advice about having people introduce their characters, because I know like in Torganized Play, when you get a new group that you haven't played with, those, you're like, "Hey, what are you?" And you might get an Orosh detective, who's describing her clothes and her little, Sherlock Holmes duck bill hat type thing, and get into that, and describe her outfit and some potions or things she has. And then you get to somebody who's just like, "I'm an Isle barbarian," and it's not saying that one of them is better than the other. "Oh, you're descriptive. I really like you. You just said you're a barbarian, but I'm gonna have problems with you." No, it's just that that's how you can get, okay, the barbarian probably wants to fight, and the investigator probably or might not have any combat skills, but has evidence analysis and find and perks and stuff that and equipment that deal with that. So that is a good observation, because when you pass out those archetypes, different people are going to explain that archetype differently to you when they're describing that same archetype, depending on what type of player they are. So what else did you have on your list that we can go through?
Well, one thing I wanted to add, which goes to pretty much any of these except for demo, is looking over the player's sheet, and seeing what skills and perks they've taken is like something you should do anyway. But pay attention to skills specifically, because sometimes that can actually tell you what their secret desires are, right? Like, what if, okay, so if they're all combat skills, this guy's going to be a combat skill. If there's no combat skill, but three adds and trick, that
Mm-hmm.
tells you something. I mean, sure, maybe they're just a mind character, but they want to be tricky, you know? So
Right.
you can often use that to tell you also what to prepare for them, make balanced encounters or make interesting encounters where they can use their stuff. If all the characters are intimidators and taunters, maybe don't have just Gospog, right? Like that sort of thing.
I'll kind of add a little side to that, because one of the things as a game master, looking at player or at the character sheets, so even in my main group, we do it very differently depending on who's the game master and what game is being ran, on whether or not the game master collects all the character sheets at the end of the night, or if everybody else takes them home and then is responsible for bringing them back. So in the same game, or same, sorry, group, when I do Torg, I usually just gather everything up, and my players are really good about getting little the like plastic envelopes with the three ring, the what do I want to call them, page protectors type thing, and they even have like little Ziploc bags that they'll put their cards in, so if we haven't ended at the end of an act, we can carry, everybody has their own little sectional thing, and then they get put in my big folder, and then I bring it back the next time and pass them out. But then the same group with another game and another game master, we all take them home. And the game master, if he has questions, he kind of asks. But one of the things that I always do, like, if I'm in a game that the game master collects the character sheet, I'm also one that I like knowing, like, my character between games. So I will literally have two character sheets, and they will say the exact same thing in the exact same order. And the game master can ask for either one of them, and they're going to be exactly the same. It's not like the one that he
You
has
don't have
is,
the cooked
yeah,
sheet.
I don't have, no cooked sheets. And then on the other game, it started off when we were doing it online, so those character sheets are still there, and I keep that character sheet updated, and then I bring the actual physical character sheet home with me, so if the game master at any time wishes to look at my character, he can jump on roll 20. So that is something that you're going to have to know about your character or your players, because I've had, before internet became, hey, this makes gaming easier, to connect with people to form groups and stuff, where I was the game master who collected all the sheets, but I would have those players who were like, no, this is my character. I, own this character. And that's when I got into the, oh, okay, just duplicate it, and if we happen to be at a place that had a copier, just make a copy of it. Or if there was like either offline or online character builders, send me the file of whatever the file is of that character, so that I can, you can have your physical copy, but I want a copy as a game master to look at. So as a game master, I agree, being able to know what your the player characters can do is important, because you can see what they want. As a player, I would highly recommend that you make sure the game master has a copy somehow, and then if you have to have that character sheet to fill whole and complete until the next time you play, make a duplicate. That works out well.
I'm pretty much playing just on roll 20 these days, so
So
I've gotten
everything's right
there.
there, right?
But I also know to be suspicious because one of my current players back in the day, like when we used to play Cyberpunk under a different ref, I know we would play a lot, right? We played a lot of Cyberpunk, and it would get to the point where the character sheets would have been erased and written over so many times that they needed to be retranscribed onto a fresh sheet.
Right.
And every time that player transcribed onto his new sheet, his intelligence would go up by one, right?
Wow, yeah, that's
It's like, so I gotta watch for that kind of stuff as well.
yeah.
So
And
that's another thing. Know if your players are cheats.
cheats. And then I'll even add to that, and it's half joking, but it has a grain of truth in it. As a game master, do you care? Because I know a lot of people are like, can't stand it, can't stand it. And like, I was talking with another game master, about stuff, and I was like, what about people who cheat dice rolls, you know, stuff like that. Like like say in Torg, he gets a 20 like every time it's important, and then when it's not, you know, that's when he might disconnect, or that's, you know, when it means absolutely nothing to the story. But as soon as a battle starts, boom, you know, he's rolling 30s and 60s and, you know, whatever glory every other round. And I was talking with that other game master, and he's like, I just figure if he really needs to cheat to feel good, then as long as it's, you know, as long as everybody else can shine, whatever, I'm not gonna call him out on it, you know, type thing. So it's one of those, like, for me as a game master, I like, you know, dice out in the open. Game master and players, I go with the, you know, no fudging dice unless it's in the rules somewhere. You know, like a game master fiat can do something, or a perk or something that, hey, if you roll and you fail, blah blah blah. But that's part of the rules then. But so, like, not rule stuff. I don't like VTTs. They help out a lot with everything just being right out there in the open.
Wound
But
penalties.
right, wound penalties, they keep you reminded of that. And then again, is the cheating happening on purpose because you purposely are not adding your wound penalties, or are you almost like everybody else who just always forgets, you know, just because you're barely wounded in Torg, and then when it happens, you're not thinking about it at that time.
We actually had a gentleman's agreement about that in Cyberpunk, is that we all of our characters would take a pain inhibitor, just so we, because that eliminates the negatives, just because we would always forget to apply them all the
Right. So you're
time.
like, okay, everybody, like, I'm making up a perk. You ignore your wound penalties. This is everybody's one of your free perks, or it's your first perk you have to buy, or something like that. So you could do that. So just figure out where your tolerance is for it. Is it something minor? Is it something big? Is it, you know, does it affect your game? Does it not affect your game? So that's all good things to know, because some people do have that, I need to win. You know, it's like, I need to win. And the different versions of win can be different for different people. Some people are like, did the group attain its goal? Did I get that new cool thing I'm looking for? One of them is, am I the star of the combat? You know, am I the, you know, if I need to bash that guy, if everybody else drops in the party, I need to be the last person standing, you know, mentality and things like that. So kind of think about how that is all working. So, did you have anything else before we wrap up?
Watch out if there's anyone who is a PvPer.
You're
Torg
right.
does not really work with that. It's not like Torg can do a lot, but it's not really that kind of game unless you're playing some Operation Eris that goes wrong or something like that.
No, I would agree, and I've been in Torg, in Torgonized play, in situations with almost got that way, and then the game master just said no PvP, period, none, none. Just figure out what you're gonna do, make it a vote, roll against a skill that's not a combat skill. You know, I tricked you into going, you know, with along with my plan, and I taunted you to go, you know, whatever. Do what you have to do. There's zero PvP happening. And the only time that we allowed it was a mind control. And then that was fun because everybody knew that that was imposed by the game master's, you know, villain mind controlling the hero. And that allowed us to have fun instead of this player specifically going against this other player. And even if your Torg Cosmverse is a little more open, people might say, yeah, I'm for PvP, but as we both mentioned earlier, that doesn't mean that they truly are. So you can go into it going,
They're
hey,
good with it as long as they're winning.
right, or if as long as their character is not the character that got PvP'd and ended up, you know, dying. So just be aware of that fact of, especially if you have people doing it, you know, PvP on others when they're not aware of it. Like, oh, I'm hurt, I need healing, and you know, the doctor goes over and is like, sticks him, you know, when he's unconscious. Oh, you know, Jeb doesn't wake up. What do you mean I don't
Or I'm
wake
gonna
up?
drink Jeb's healing potion while he's asleep, you
Right,
know?
you know, just something like that, and the player doesn't know it. And then they're mad because their character died. They don't know why their character died. They feel that their character didn't die, but it's like you agreed to this, you know, possibility at the beginning, but they're upset. So Torg, I would even, like you said, even in the little like Operation Eris, even in Operation Soft Cell, that kind of dabbles in that territory. The group, it's much better if the group at least is cohesive. Maybe they hate everybody else in the world, but at least they're cohesive. And don't necessarily, while you want to play in character, I found that at least 95% of the time when a person says, oh, that's what my character would do, it's to do something bad to another character.
It's what my character would do holds no water for me since they designed the character to do that.
Right. So it's like, you shouldn't have did it that way. So having said all of that, hopefully it gave you some thoughts about
things
how,
to look out for.
Yes, the things to look out for, different types of players to kind of understand what might make games better for them, how you might balance things, get everybody involved. And again, hopefully, if you do have that group that can get you far, you can use some of these things that we talked about to make sure that it keeps going that way, because like I said, people do change, especially over the years. Their mindset changes, their experience have changed, their ways, their points of view and stuff might have changed. So you might have to shift your game in a 3 years ago, this was fine. Why are my players kind of pushing back now? Things might have changed. So even if you don't necessarily agree with all the, hey, we're going to have a session zero, a lot of that stuff you can look at and just do it really quickly, or, you know, just say, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? Okay, now we can, you know, go on. But be aware that sometimes they say, and it's not necessarily like malicious, but sometimes, you know, if you would ask me, I would have been like, I'm the socializer. I want to do the role playing. I want to do this. And the more I like started listening to stuff, I'm like, actually, I'm more of an explorer, and I never would have thought that. I would have been like, you know, number one would be socializer, number two combat, and then this explorer. But no, actually, you know, the explorer. And then I found out in the Gen Con game, when I got a focus and I got a time limit, then I'm the achiever, you know. So you might say something as a person, absolutely believe it, but not necessarily, you know, that truth or changes in the situation. So having said that, thank you very much for either watching or listening to this episode. You can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. Like Oliver did, we can, if you send us questions, we'll answer them to the best of our ability, or you can just send us comments. Either way, until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.